This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. My special guest today is the Professor of Economics Emeritus at Texas A&M University, a former Chief Economist for the Department of Labor 2001-2002. He's also served as the Director of the Criminal Justice Center and is a Senior Fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, Dallas, Texas. He's the author, co-author of six books, and is in a very small group of most controversial members of the 9/11 research community. I'm very proud he's a member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. It's a pleasure to welcome to the dynamic duo Morgan Reynolds. Morgan, welcome.
Thank you, Jim.
It's a real pleasure, and it was terrific to have you here in Madison for the conference on what's controversial, what's not. It's been amusing to me, Morgan, that I've heard a criticism raised that some of the topics and some of the speakers at that conference were controversial.
Well, if people would recognize the truth, there wouldn't be so much resistance to it, would there? You know,
I know.
That's the first public 9/11 speaking engagement I've had since back in October of 06 when Dr. Judy Wood and I were invited to Seattle. So I know I'm not the most popular guy, but I could care less.
Well, I'm proud of my efforts to resuscitate your speaking career.
Well, I've had one in 2007.
Well, we'll see if we can't improve on that,
right,
Morgan. I thought to involve, you know, representatives across the spectrum in relation to 9/11 research. I invited Stephen Jones. I invited Kevin Ryan. Neither of them was even responsive to my invitations, which I extended more than once. In fact, I arranged to have Frank Greening come and speak, and he agreed after I'd interviewed him on this very show, but then subsequently withdrew. And when I asked him if he had withdrawn because of pressure being exerted on him to not attend, he declined to answer the question, which I think makes it quite apparent what was going on here.
Yeah, that's an admission.
It's really disappointing when you have an occasion like this, and particularly when you have, you know, when there are such exceptional presentations as those by Judy Wood, by Bob Petraeus, by Jerry Liepart, by yourself, by Ace Baker on these especially controversial issues, and then it's supplemented by a lot of work on related issues by Doug Rocky, Lauren Murray, and Alfred Weber. I thought we really put a lot of issues on the table.
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. Of course, too bad it wasn't better attended, but we can expand the audience through DVDs and the book.
That's right. That's exactly right, Morgan. In fact, the DVDs are in production now, and I hope that they will be available by the end of this month.
And like on my website, we're going to talk a little bit about my PowerPoint presentation at Madison, so you can gain access to these resources after the fact.
Well, that's a great idea. Why don't we go to your website, which, of course, is nomoregames.net. And is there a link from the homepage, Morgan? Or
right. Over on the left, you'll see a column of subjects, and click on 9/11. And let's see, we got a list. And the Madison What Planes presentation is the fourth item down.
Okay.
And this PowerPoint should show up. Now, I'm going to edit things. And
sure.
Why don't you? Do you have the little guide on the left?
Yes, I do. Yes,
okay.
I do.
Okay. In that case, go down to. It's going to be slide 8, but it says in the headline, "Media 9/11 Complicity."
Yes.
Of course, the talk is titled "What Planes?"
Yes.
And the media, if I'm right and other so-called no-planers are right, of course, the media has to be in on it at a very high level to put fake video or film on the television. And I argue that this is one reason that this may be the single most important issue on 9/11, because if we're right and they faked four airliner crashes, that leads pretty immediately right to the powers that be, the deep politics, the invisible permanent government. And it's interesting that we had the largest manhunt in the history of the FBI, and it took them 17 years to apprehend Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. And the only reason, of course, they did was his brother gave him up to the FBI.
Yes.
Yet, in this next slide, you're going to see that a Fox News anchor solved 9/11, or who was the chief suspect, within 45 seconds.
That's so pretty good, isn't it?
This is pretty good work. So if you click on that pointer to the right, and we're going to get this Fox News video to run here in a few seconds. It should run automatically. Mine is. Is that the way it's working for you?
I'm not quite sure where I should be clicking, Morgan. I'm on the...
I just want you to go to slide 9.
Slide 9, okay.
The next slide?
Right. No, I'm there. Yeah, it's...
Is it...
It's opening right.
Okay. And listen to... can you play this anchor, his audio?
Yeah, I think I can.
I can put it on my telephone.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot here.
Okay.
I am reminded of a couple of things that happened recently, Dr. Groves. Not long ago, within the last couple of weeks, in fact, there was a pilot who flew. There was another one. We just saw another one apparently go. Another plane just flew into the second tower. This has to be deliberate, folks.
Well, I would begin to say that, yeah.
We just saw on live television as a second plane flew into the second tower of the World Trade Center. Now, given what has been going on around the world, some of the key suspects come to mind, Osama bin Laden. Who knows?
45 seconds.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, that's it, Jim. Stop that, okay? Yep.
This is 6-7 floors were taken out. And there's more explosions right now. Hold on, people are running.
Hold on just a moment. We've got an explosion inside.
The building's exploding right now. You got people running up the street.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on.
Okay, just put Winston on pause there for just a moment.
Okay, the whole building just exploded some more. The whole top part.
Okay.
The building's still intact. People are running up the street.
Now, we already solved the case, Morgan. So.
Yes, 45 seconds it took that Fox.
45 seconds.
So they need him at the FBI.
I think so. I think that's fantastic. I mean, I'm impressed.
Well, so to me, that almost as delicious as the BBC reporter at 4:50 in the afternoon or so.
4:57, 23 minutes too early.
Right. So
announcing the collapse of Building 7, and you can see it over her left shoulder. Hold that thought, Morgan. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest today, Morgan Reynolds. My special guest today is a former director of the Criminal Justice Center and senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis in Dallas, Texas, the author, co-author of 6 books, and a controversial guy in the 9/11 research community. His name is Morgan Reynolds, and we're talking about research he's done on the possibility that the events in New York City involving aircraft were actually managed using fake videos. And I got to say, Morgan, there's just a tremendously interesting body of evidence here that suggests you just may be right about this. Now,
compelling.
Pardon?
Compelling.
Compelling. And I noticed, you know, this guy on Fox solved it within 45 seconds. You know, that's even better than they do on Law and Order. In fact, if they solved it in 45 seconds, they wouldn't have any content for the programs.
Right. they spend a lot more, you know, in time and resources investigating horse doping scandals or steroid use and track and field and baseball and It's absurd. And they want to, of course, rush right on by with as little as investigation as they can with regard to the most important political event of the 21st century. Okay, next I want to go to slide 13, Jim.
Okay.
I don't want to spend much time really on the
Pentagon.
No plane flew into the Pentagon evidence, which is accepted by a pretty, it seems to me, majority of 9/11.
Practically everyone, with the exception of Jim Hoffman and a small clique
right.
of his friends.
Yeah. And you just start out, the hole's too small to disappear a Boeing 757, which is the size nearly of a half of a football field. You know, when you if you parked a 757, it's quite although it's considered a medium-sized airliner, it's half the size of a football field. So
right, it's 155 feet long. You're absolutely
yeah,
right, Marty.
Yeah, and a football field's 160 feet wide. And it's true you'll have a little room left over with a 125-foot wingspan.
Right.
And you'd have 150 feet, half of a football field to fit it, but you'd only have about 12 feet left over at each end. So,
yeah.
And, of course, you couldn't get two 767s on a football field. But
hey, Morgan, do you notice in this diagram how the engines are minimized? I mean, they're almost not there at all because, of course, if they hit the ground floor, they'd be plowing furrows in the lawn.
Yes. Right, yeah. Where are the engine marks?
It's
the whole thing is impossible. But what I want to point out here is something that very few people have observed. If a Boeing were actually to strike this Pentagon wall at this 45-degree angle or thereabouts, the right wing, the starboard wing and engine would hit the wall first after the nose of the fuselage.
Yeah.
As this diagram illustrates. And that means that the wrecking ball, which is the Pentagon itself, would crack that wing and spin that plane clockwise here.
Yeah.
And that tail would fly off.
Snap right off,
it
like we've seen in some
off.
Landings. We've seen
it
on
would,
some landings at much lower speeds.
It would go for hundreds of feet. Yeah, so the whole thing is absurd.
I like that, Morgan.
Then if we just go to, I want to go to slide 18, which is plane fact number 2. No plane crashed at Shanksville. It's
okay.
A designated site.
Okay.
And here again, we can just spend a couple of minutes on this before we go to the most controversial of all.
Sure.
And that is, notice the script there. The Todd Beamer and company, you know, rushing the cockpit. And by the way, you could never get two beefy pilots out of those cockpits are real snug. And to pull a 200-pound man out of there who's resisting, it would just be impossible without a crew of four men or something to struggle with them. It's just,
yeah.
At any rate, let's roll. I can remember my wife's oldest daughter. She said, "That sounds like Bush," and it does, doesn't it? Let's roll in Afghanistan
Bush.
Or somewhere else. We can kill people with
bring it on,
turbans on their head or something.
I love it. Yeah,
and it's just such a lie. And I compare it here to the propaganda about Jessica Lynch and Pat Tillman, which have largely failed. So at Shanksville, that is one fact I want to point out in this little list here is the second bullet from the bottom on this slide. There's no grass burned, despite thousands of gallons of jet fuel aboard Flight 93.
Yeah, 23 or 24,000 gallons.
Here again, you know, there's just no facts to support the claim that a Flight 93 Boeing 757 crashed there. Okay, now let's go to the real hot issue, which is plane fact number 3. It would be slide 24 had it been numbered here.
Okay.
And by way of introduction to analyze this issue, we note that we can call it a taboo subject. And there are a lot of, I call them gatekeepers or ops or plants. There are ignoramuses. That's excusable for many, but maybe not for some others, right? In other words, we all have our heavy doses of ignorance on various topics. And that is can be remedied, at least in principle. So there's a lot of resistance to this view that we've been bamboozled by various kinds of fakery to believe that airliners went into the towers. Now, I claim that no such crashes could have occurred in the Twin Towers as depicted because the physics are impossible. And I hope to back that up here in this broadcast and other forums. And by way of getting people to be receptive, we've got to keep in mind that 9/11 was a kind of magic show, right? It was a false flag terror event. It was a hoax. Now, it seems to me a lot of people are receptive to that idea, yet it seems to me they reason that, well, the government and the respectable media lied to me about items A, B, and C, but not D. Oh, no, I saw it on TV. I saw it on TV.
Hold that thought, Morgan. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We'll be right back. My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration. And you know, Morgan, some people would criticize you or me or I suppose David Ray Griffin because, I mean, Griffin, I mean, his area is religion, mine philosophy, yours economics. But my God, your background in economics makes you very used to dealing with mathematics, with precise and exact thinking. You've published 6 books. You're a qualified scholar. I mean, Griffin's published over 30. I've published not quite as many. I mean, you know, we know how to conduct research. And I think some of these arguments are just so baseless. It's a real pleasure to have you back to talk about these issues. And, you know,
science, as somebody famous said a couple centuries ago, no doubt, is refined common sense. So, right? That puts that straight. But I wish we did have more field experts stepping forward to work on this issue, too. That would certainly help us out.
I think it's happening, Morgan. You know, if you went to 911scholars.org and clicked on Patriots Question 9/11, you'd find this proliferation of different, you know, lists, at least, of individuals in a whole range of different areas that are getting involved. And I think that it's all, you know, all to the good.
Yes.
So that I think,
and really, you know, people like you and I and others become, we're kind of an army of in the hundreds, become experts because we devote ourselves full time to this for years.
That's absolutely right.
And
I like your willingness, of course, to pick up on the complex and controversial issues. My opinion is those are the only ones worth debating.
Yeah, that's that's my kind of personality, too, where people say, don't go there. I need to sniff around and find out why they don't want me to go there.
Yes.
So I to go back to one of my few trips on 9/11 speaking engagements a year ago, October, I went to Seattle, and I flew up there on a Boeing 767, and I looked out. I was the seat, the aisle I was in was over the wing, and I looked at out at the wing, and I think it was a Delta airliner, as I recall, but marked all over the wing was no step.
You mean they're that sturdy they can cut through steel and concrete buildings, but you can't step on them?
Yeah, isn't that weird? And now here again, a 200-pound man can do apparently too much damage. Well, I happened to fly last week to the East Coast, and I went from Charlotte, North Carolina, up to LaGuardia on it was U.S. Airways Airbus 319, which is about the size of a Boeing 737. That's a smaller airliner than a 757 or 767, but it can seat about 125, of course, single aisle. Well, here, lo and behold, where am I seated? Over the wing again, or the aisle is. And I look out, and it says about 40% of the way away from the fuselage. Before you get to the halfway mark, it says, do not walk outside this area. And it says it four times, you know, in both directions. Do not walk outside this area. So here again, I'm wondering, gee whiz, what are they protecting out there? You know, is this wing got some weakness to it?
What kind of damage could you have done with your 9-pound sledge?
Yeah. Yeah, Jim's referring to my sledgehammer that I brought to the conference, and I had a piece of aluminum, too, which is about a rod, about the thickness of what they have on the skin, of the fuselage of the airliners. And I could get up on an airliner in 15 minutes. Wow, wailing on that thing, it would be unflyable.
I think that's absolutely right. You mentioned a 737, by the way. Wasn't a 737 landing gear found in the streets of New York under a canopy and above undamaged sidewalk?
It's claimed by some aircraft experts that the turbine part found there is from a 737 engine, something smaller than what would power the 767. Now, the landing gear, I haven't heard that claim, I should follow up on that and see what we can learn. But here, if we go to the next couple slides, I really got a list of things that are wrong that make us suspect that an aluminum airliner cannot disappear inside a steel and concrete tower.
You're telling me that plane was made of aluminum?
Yeah. Most Boeing 767s are, yes. That's the predominant material. Of course, there's some cloth there on the seats and some padding. And you know, there's plexiglass and all kinds of materials, but aluminum is the dominant one for the frame and the skin.
So we're talking about a flying beer can.
Right. It's a hollow tube with a couple of engines and wings is a pretty easy way to characterize it. And then this PowerPoint show, I show you some pictures from the Boeing factory to show that this is a good way to think about it. And so an aluminum airliner cannot fly into a steel and tower concrete and disappear inside. One of the many problems is, you mean you're telling me it's invincible when it meets the wall, but then somehow it's highly fragile when it gets inside, where it somehow shreds apart.
You know, Morgan, when I first took a look at some of those film clips, you know, the plane just sort of melting into the building, I really didn't know what to think about it. But, I mean, your point is so elegant and obvious that the physics of the interaction just wouldn't permit this rather flimsy airline to just melt through this steel and concrete building. I mean, it just couldn't happen.
Yeah, United Airlines Flight 175 is purportedly the plane going into the South Tower, the second hit, and I call that the immaculate penetration.
Yeah. Right?
It just slides in there without any collision or crash.
Immaculate
all the videos that show this immaculate penetration don't actually have anything that Newton would recognize or any of us would recognize. So it's just absurd. Now, there's a kind of a debate over this, whether we get deceleration or not, and if so, how much. But I would claim my colleague Rick Ryder didn't find any, and that would be an absurd violation of Newton's first law of motion or the law of inertia. I'm going to take that up in a little more detail later. But where'd all the debris go? Actually, you remember Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani, who used to be active in 9/11, and I've stolen this statement from her. Actually, she calls these the four cleanest crash sites in aviation history. So, at the World Trade Center, where's the debris below the impact zones? Nobody's ever shown any evidence of such debris, nor is there any visible in the gashes. And remember, a Boeing 767 is 159 feet long, a good three-quarters the length of a wall of the World Trade Center tower. and almost, but it's about three quarters the width of,
yeah,
of the wall too, because they're about 208 feet long square.
Right.
And the holes are undersized and they're obstructed. You know, it's not a clean fit. And of course, the plane-shaped holes. Here again, this is an absurdity on a par with the Roadrunner or Tom and Jerry cartoon where you run through a wall. And
wouldn't it work like a grater?
Wouldn't it
sort of shred the plane through those
even
steel?
Even if it did, well, there'd be shattering, crumpling, and rotating.
This plane would
just be devastated. There would be some damage in the building, but it'd be a Tower 100 in plane two.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, has been investigating the role of the aircraft on 9/11 and has come up with some very interesting conclusions based upon his analysis. We're on his website, nomoregames.net, and going through a PowerPoint presentation he gave here in Madison at a conference on controversial aspects of 9/11. Morgan.
Yes. If we look at slide 26, I want to focus on one of these points, and that is the WTC-2, or South Tower plane image, was turning left. Remember all that talk about, it almost missed the building, and it hits on the right side of the south wall.
Indeed.
And it was banking. If you look at the outline, the cartoon-like silhouette of passage, you know, it's 38 degrees from zero,
mm-hmm,
horizontal. And yet we're supposed to pretend that this would be a flush hit. In other words, that the nose would hit this building at a 90-degree perpendicular angle. Well, once you recognize a real plane turning left, the building and the wing would collide there on the left side first, right? And if that wing and engine complex is whacked by the building, it's not going to give much. It's going to spin that plane to the opposite way, the counterclockwise. It's going to bang that thing like a wrecking ball would. It's going to fling that tail section off counterclockwise. To the east.
Just like the Pentagon in the opposite direction.
Right, opposite direction. So to talk about this plane disappearing in there, it's just, to me, of course, it's laughable. But, if you took a poll, people nod their head. Oh, yeah, sure thing. Now, the next slide is that Herzog-Kahny CNN, one of the frames from that, which shows about nearly halfway penetrating and various kinds of anomalies, impossibilities as it slides into this structure. And then if we go to the next one, we've been having a controversy lately over whether a Boeing 767 could actually fly at 500 miles an hour plus at sea level. And while it doesn't seem to be a clean, hard denial that it could. As you know, of course, Joseph Keith, an aeronautical or software design engineer, argues that it would shake apart, that although NASA claims you could develop enough thrust to offset the thick air and near sea level, Joe Keith and some others doubt it, that you could really develop the thrust to offset the air density and drag at that level. So that's still in process, I would say, in terms of getting a definitive answer. If you go to the next slide, 29, I raise the question, how strong are planes anyway? How strong would they be?
I'll call you in about 5 minutes at a break.
We're going to have a break?
Yeah. No, you can. Go right ahead, Morgan.
Okay. So I'm mocking this idea. Do airplanes have crash test ratings? No, they don't. You know, there's no such thing as equivalent to automobiles of a five-star crash-rated airplane. And we don't have any steel or concrete airplanes. We have these aluminum. And they're remarkably fragile. They don't have a real over-design factor because they're designed to be lightweight and carry the payload maximum and meet the stresses of flying, landing, and takeoff. They really are not designed to absorb much punishment with other solid objects. So one way to demonstrate this is to say, well, do they weigh your luggage? Yeah, they do. When you go in a building, they never worry about what your luggage weighs, do they? And that's because the redundancy factor, the over-design factor, is so much greater in a building. But airplanes don't have this big margin. So now, Jim, I go through a whole series of pictures, true ones I selected, but they show you the nature of aircraft. So in slide 30, we see a twin-engine light plane, how it's sliced up by an encounter with a propeller. And then in the next one, we see another propeller gouging into another lighter aircraft. So I start off with smaller planes. Here's a plane that flew into a residence and didn't get very far in slide 32. Not a whole lot of damage visible in the building. Slide 33 is kind of interesting. These are all captures from the Internet.
Yeah.
And this plane here went into the Bank of America building in Tampa, Florida, when an alleged teenage devotee of Osama bin Laden stole the plane, he didn't hijack it, he flew it off out of the airport and crashed into the building here.
Yes.
And this is about what I expect. You got most of the plane hanging out of a window, and you see some damage up top there. I'm not sure if that's part of a wing or whatever, but this is the kind of thing I'd expect. Here again, we're talking low speed and smaller planes. Now, here is the apartment building that Corey Lytle and his instructor, the New York Yankees pitcher, Corey Lytle and
yeah.
his instructor, ran into this apartment building on the east side of Manhattan. And I've got various shots. You can see how much damage this plane did to this brick-and-mortar-type apartment building. And that looks like an enhanced. I'm looking at slide 36, if you're following along.
Okay, I was at 34. Let's see, 35.
Yeah, I'm going to go
36.
To, go to 37. You can see the kind of plane they were flying, the Cirrus Design SR-20.
Yes.
Four-seater. Of course, these are pretty small. And then on slide 38, we see some debris from below the impact zone. And then slide 39 shows some, too. So I expect airplane debris to be in an impact. All the materials should be there but for material that would have burned up. I don't expect any real vaporization, you know, except for the fuel burned. Then slide 40 looks at bird strikes on airplanes. Birds can be a problem. And you can see how this one is pretty funny with the claws of this bird, the feet being... This is from actually the rear horizontal stabilizer winglet.
Are these birds tougher than 500,000-ton steel and concrete buildings?
Right, and here's the kind of plane I used to fly on as a commuter in the College Station, Texas, between DFW. And look at this one. See, you've got the big engine there with the three stripes.
I love the little ears sticking out.
This almost looks like a put-up picture, doesn't it?
It does. It looks staged. The little ears, as it were, popping up.
Really cutting into the aluminum canvassing, if you will, over the wing there.
Those are actually the bird's wings, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, here we get into the big planes. Here's an airliner with a bird strike on the leading edge here.
Uh-huh.
And, by the way, I was looking at the Airbus 319, the aileron or panel action at the front of the wing.
Yeah.
And that thing is not very... thick. It looks pretty thin to the my passenger's eyes. Here's another, the front end. There's a couple of bird strikes on the near the nose of the fuselage of this plane.
Slide 43.
And then here you can see a winglet being cut into the tail section of this passing plane.
Morgan, hold right there, and we'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. We'll return with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, has been a professor of economics at Texas A&M. He's been a director of a Justice Institute in Dallas. He has been an student of many aspects of 9/11, and we're going through his website and talking about a PowerPoint presentation he made in Madison about whether or not planes hit the World Trade Center. Alex, are you there?
In public health.
Sorry. We got a background again. Thank you. Morgan, let's continue.
Yes.
You're talking about where this one plane sliced through another. We're on slide 44.
I want to go to slide 45, and excuse me, perhaps we can wrap up this part of the program in this segment.
Sure.
Here we see a Continental Airlines 727 at Newark, and it rolled into the terminal. And the cockpit area and back got crushed. And if we go to there are a couple more shots of this, when they backed it out, you see how fragile this area is.
And that went into the building at, what, 5 miles an hour or less?
Probably, right? You know, it's a parking lot accident, a fender bender. And if you look at the building, I don't think any of those panels of glass were shattered.
They don't seem to have been.
And there is a little bit of damage to the edge of that, what looks to be precast concrete. But
yeah.
The airplane suffered the worst of it by far. And then there's slide 47. They're hauling it away. And as I understand it, no one was hurt, fortunately. But you can see how delicate these aircraft are. We like to think of them as being a sturdy, single, indivisible units, but they aren't. If we go to the next one, slide 48, you can see that one of these little engines, these what do they call that? They're basically tow craft,
yeah.
You know, for luggage trailers. And it put a big ding into this, but it's steel, and this engine surround is aluminum.
Yeah, so, I don't see a lot of damage to the mover.
No, that's some pretty sturdy stuff. Here we see an Air France plane losing a wingtip when it hit their runway.
49.
And then we've got a, this one is near and dear to my heart. There were 12 fatalities in this accident because it occurred. The reason I'm interested is it's the airport I use, LIT, Little Rock's airport. And in very stormy rainstorm, back in June of 1999, this MD, what is it, an 82? MD-82, which, of course, is Boeing because Boeing bought out McDonnell Douglas, but this thing slid off the runway, and it ran into this walkway. I call it a walkway. It's for approach lights, lighting. So it outran the runway and is just devastated. All the fuselage is shattered into three major pieces. It caught fire. 12 died out of 143 aboard. I mean, that a little amount of steel just wrecked this whole plane. It's a total disaster. And then 53 is one more shot of that same accident. Now I want to go back, Jim. Let's go back to I have a clip of a B-52 crashing. It's only, I think, 20 seconds or so. If you go back to slide 23, we can repeat it and watch how this B-52, which is practicing tricks, and this trick didn't quite make it.
Yes.
Slide 23.
Do we need the soundtrack? Or?
This is a... there's no soundtrack.
Yeah,
I don't think.
I'm looking at it.
And
this is one of the best planes ever made.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the heavy bomber. It's been since, what, the mid-50s?
Yeah.
The United States
Workhorse.
Air Force. And that thing, it's bigger than a Boeing 767 in terms of its wingspan. It's 185 feet, But we're talking about the same order of magnitude aircraft. It's got a narrower fuselage. Run it again if you click on that little delta.
123.
Again.
Yeah.
And I want to note two things. Watch this wing come off when it hits the ground.
Ah, yes.
The right wing, it's just falling, you know, right off the fuselage. And look at how black this fireball, the smoke associated with the fire is. That is not what we had at the South Tower. It was too gray, whitish gray. It wasn't black enough. That's the way a real a plane crash looks. Now I want to go back. Let's see. Let's go back to slide 74, which is that's going to be the CNN link. It's going to take us there. Let's see if we can click on that.
Can we click on the link? Yeah, I did.
Yeah, if we click on this, we're going to see a Boeing 767, which is hijacked, crash into the ocean off Comoros. Let's see, is that going to light up for
us? Yeah, I'm watching it.
Oh, okay.
It played for me.
Okay, yeah, there it is. I didn't click hard enough. Watch this get shattered. Look at that right wing.
And this is a 767?
Yeah. It's the only hijacked 767 in history prior to 9/11. Of course, I then say it's the only hijacked 767 in history. No 767 or 757 has ever been hijacked.
Do you think water is a less dense surface than steel and concrete?
Water is going to just tear the plane up, much less a steel and concrete building. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
You know, I was asking my wife what I meant to say when I used the word grater. I meant actually slicer. I mean, wouldn't those, the external steel support columns function like a slicer if the plane...
Well, to some extent it would, that is, the vertical beams especially, would hold back some and would tear around. Actually, we in my article of March 2006, Rick Ryder had a very good analysis. We have that in the article. We have some holes in the plane stories.
Right.
But you would actually have the result of that would be more debris below the impact zone. That's the short of it. You wouldn't have it all neatly sucked into the building.
Uh-huh.
So we...
Oh, I agree with that, Morgan.
Yeah.
I agree. I just wondered whether...
We proved that up, I think. Now, let's go back to how strong is steel anyway, which is really slide 75.
Yeah.
And I've got to, you know, we all know steel is strong. So look at the bed of this dump truck, and that boulder weighs many, many tons.
Which slide number is it?
We're at slide 75.
Oh, 75, yeah.
Look at this boulder leaning on the edge of that dump truck bed.
Yes.
Aluminum can't do that.
Yes.
And if we go a couple more slides, well, there I say, there's my dare. Let me up on top with a sledgehammer, 9 pounds of steel.
Right.
I'll wreck the plane for you.
Right.
Well, here's some shots we have all seen of the towers under construction. I'm on slide 78 now.
Uh-huh.
The steel's very strong. I've got the numbers here out of a Mechanics of Materials book. Steel's stronger than aluminum. That's the short of it. No news there.
That doesn't seem too difficult a lesson to absorb.
No.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, if I'm reading him right, seems to believe that a guy named Newton had something to say about interactions of the kind that were presented during broadcasts on 9/11 of planes interacting with concrete and steel towers. Do I read you right, Morgan?
Yes, you do. I'm very old-fashioned. I'm very pre-9/11. I think that Newton's laws of mechanics still hold.
You're a classical physics kind of guy, huh?
I believe that basic physics.
You don't think this was a quantum jump that led that plane into the building?
But, you know, it is amusing at one level, but our country has reached such a low level that NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, believes to the contrary. In other words, their modeling violates Newtonian mechanics. And We might, at this point, there's a lot of good stuff about that issue on this PowerPoint, but maybe in the interest of time, we could go to a second document, because this, in a sense, gets it more real world. If we go back to the 9/11 area in
yes.
my website,
yes.
the top entry is one that NIST denies Reynolds' request for correction, preliminary thoughts.
Yes.
So if you click on that, this can be our guide. And as you and others know, I filed a request for correction back in March of this year, contending that NIST has delivered a fraudulent analysis and animations of airplanes entering into the Twin Towers.
Well, here we recover Newton again, so I think we're right on track.
So we pick up on Newton, and the more I write about Sir Isaac Newton, the more I admire his work, and the better I get at it. And, of course, with the help of Dr. Judy Wood, who is a Ph.D. engineer and has taught such courses, you and I doubt that we've had statics or the basic mechanics
sure.
course in engineering. So,
hate to admit it, Morgan.
Nonetheless, we can understand high school physics. We're not that old yet, Jim.
Well, I don't know, Morgan.
So, what has happened was it took NIST over 6 months for some reason. Usually, they replied said within 60 days. Took them over 6 months to compose this 3 or 4 page letter denying my request for correction. I said, you guys need to correct this for a variety of reasons I've enumerated, okay? And so they deny my request for correction. Now, I've got the right to appeal within 30 days, and their denial letter was of September 28th. So I still have some time left, okay? Meanwhile, I filed 2 FOIA requests for data. They claim they've got original source pictures and videos that I don't have access to. They say only their personnel can access it on a secure server. So I said, hey, you give me that so I can exercise my appeal rights properly. Okay, well, so they've denied me, and I have a right to appeal, and we'll go another round on this. And what I claim is they're modeling, and they're treating these videos literally violates the basic laws of physics. You and I both agree on that. You can't have a plane run into a building at high speed and not have a collision crash and the parts being flung here and there, and you can't have this gliding into a building. So
the force with which the building is being hit by the plane is equal to the force with which the plane
right.
is hitting the building.
Right. That's Newton's third law, equal and opposite. And if you look at this, in a sense, a draft of my appeal, this is just my preliminary thoughts. First of all, if we go to Roman 1, NIST versus Newton, right away the fight's over. You know, if I'm right, NIST is contrary to Newton. I'll take Newton anytime. What we have, of course, is crashes are mundane. They happen all the time. Right? There were thousands of crashes today, collisions of bodies. And the elementary physics of these interactions has never been known to vary. Now, here's what's incredible. There's on page 2, actually, NIST says the following in their denial letter. Both the aircraft and the towers included deformable components and materials whose interactions were properly accounted for in the models.
They're not talking about the relative degree of deformity?
Well, not yet. So
yeah.
I don't have any real problem with this.
Yeah,
but for the properly accounted for in the models. That's what I'm objecting to. Listen to the next sentence. As a result, the aircraft would not be expected to decelerate.
That's really, you know, that's ridiculous.
That is absurd. You know, that's a violation of law one at a minimum, you know. In other words, the law of inertia.
Well, it's implying the plane would pass through the building with us at the same velocity that it hit the building.
This is absurd. It would not be expected to decelerate immediately upon impact with the exterior wall of the tower.
But that's it would begin to decelerate.
It has to immediately.
Unless this is made of tissue and cardboard.
Right, unless no force was exerted on the plane, and therefore the tower. So this is a breathtaking admission. So if we look at these 5 points, here's one way to argue this. Deformation of materials requires energy. You know, is anybody going to contest that? Two, energy can only be spent once. Three, if energy is used to deform materials, it must come from somewhere. Four, energy used to deform materials is not available to maintain constant speed. And then five, unless the flying object can find a new energy source, it must slow. Because the energy consumed deforming materials isn't available to keep speed constant. So this is just a ridiculous proposition. Now, I go into this even further, and that is NIST modeling. By the way, in the letter, Jim, listen to this stuff. They say, the analytical modeling methodologies used by NIST were reviewed by individual subject matter experts who also serve on the National Construction Safety Team Advisory Committee and by experts retained by NIST as consultants.
So,
you know, I'm not impressed.
As all these guys weren't hired guns.
These individuals have all agreed.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds. And, Morgan, I must say, you have so much important stuff for us to discuss. I want to know if, rather than trying to rush it today, you might be able to return on Tuesday and we could continue our conversation and you could cover more of the points than you would be able to discuss today.
Be fine. Sure.
Okay, I'm going to mark you down for Tuesday, which is the 23rd, for a continuation, and I'm delighted that you can do that. Let's pick it up then with your response to NIST, or NIST's response to you.
Right, yeah. Well, to quickly review, NIST denied my request for correction of their study of the what happened at the World Trade Center. Of course, they didn't proceed very far in the study because they didn't want to look at the actual destruction process. So they only proceed up to the point of initiation of collapse, so-called. But that means they had to model the airplane. So there's they're really caught in a catch-22. If they take the videos literally, which is what they've done, the videos violate Newtonian mechanics. So they've got to violate Newtonian mechanics. So my heart really doesn't go out to them for this problem they've got. But it's a big mallet I've got to pound them into the ground. And we know you can't have a contradiction in nature. So unless they want to contest that. And I'm right here in the article, as I say, if a plane continues to fly at the same speed, no force has been applied to it. That would, in other words, this is an application of Newton's first law of motion,
right,
or the law of inertia.
Right.
So I really scornfully say, well, since we can't have this contradiction, maybe there are six possible explanations to reconcile this apparent exception to Newton's first law. Well, you could argue, A, that the first law never was generally valid, you know, that the master scientist, he neglected to account for this time lag between the impact of colliding bodies and deceleration. Well, yeah, okay. B, the physical law has general validity, but was suspended in New York City between 8:46 and 9:03 a.m. on 9/11, perhaps by Muslim terrorists. And then C, since the Twin Towers and jetliners were built long after Sir Isaac Newton died, his old-fashioned laws couldn't be expected to apply to these biologically inspired designs over a course and their interaction with jetliners, which he never thought of. And then D, pre-9/11 mechanics no longer apply. These are all variations on a theme, right? That A through D, that Newton's laws of basic physics no longer work. And then there's two other possibilities that why the law of inertia doesn't hold, and that was, okay, the law of inertia holds, but the buildings were a figment of our imagination, and there wasn't a real interaction between the bodies.
What's the beauty of it, of course, Morgan, is that these principles are so elementary and obviously well established that it's simply absurd to suggest the laws of nature can't be violated and they can't be changed. They require no enforcement, completely contrary to laws of society, like speed limits, for example, or drinking age laws or what have you, which can be violated and changed all the time.
Right, and all the engineering applications are based on Newtonian physics or mechanics, and so engineers need to learn that that Newton's first law is invalid.
This is so embarrassing, Morgan, that the engineers at NIST must just be humiliated.
Right. Now, that is a very good point, because NIST, like any other large organization, is not monolithic. And, of course, you've got careerists. I saw that inside the U.S. Department of Labor. You've got career people who are dedicated and believe that they're doing a good thing as well as doing good for themselves. But then you bring in the politicos, and the politicos are loyal to George W. Bush. And they want a predetermined political result here. So it just must be agonizing within the agency.
You must have noticed that the former head of the NIST Fire Investigation Division has called for a reinvestigation because he himself has no confidence in the NIST's report.
Yes, I noticed that. And I think that's a good thing, that we need all the help we can get, at least if it's genuine. And I believe he left the agency in the early 90s, but he laments the politicization of the agency.
This is an aside, but this business about loyalty to Bush, I've had a couple of indications, one from a Sarah Taylor, who was an assistant to Karl Rove, another from the B-1 bomber pilot who actually took out Saddam Hussein, both of whom said that they had had a loyalty oath that they had signed or taken to George W. Bush rather than to the Constitution. And I am suspicious that they have done this throughout the administration.
I remember my little interview outside the executive office building when I first showed up as the newly appointed chief economist, and the woman there, the political from the White House, her first question was, what have you done to elect George W. Bush? And that was the tone. I can tell you that the mantra that whole first term was to reelect George W. Bush. It was never an issue about what was the right thing to do for America. So I saw it point blank. So I can believe this story. If it's not true, it's true apocryphally. Jim, if we go to Newton's second law, sometimes called the law of acceleration, if you apply a force at the front of a plane, it must slow, it must decelerate, and the back or tail of the plane. I mean, this sounds so almost asinine, right, to be going over this elementary stuff, but you and I know, in Jones' journal, Greg Jenkins is taking issue with this. He's a PhD physicist. Well, the back or tail of the plane must slow unless it's not, the back isn't connected to the rear and they got disconnected with no loss of energy. So under Newtonian physics, deceleration must be proportional to the force applied. And if you had this high-speed Boeing running into this 500,000-ton tower, there'd be a lot of force. A lot. And let's see where we go from
here. And, of course,
here.
You're talking about force applied to the front in the opposite direction of the velocity of the plane.
Right.
If you were to strap a new jetpack on the front, you know, to accelerate it further forward, that wouldn't have the same effect as in the opposite direction.
Right. And I think the most easily understood is Newton's third law, you know, equal and opposite.
Yes.
All forces occur in pairs, and they're equal in magnitude and opposite direction. So the force imposed, impressed on the building is the same in magnitude as the force impressed on the airplane. And then the question is, in this collision, which one is going to survive it better?
Well, I like your use of the law of inertia, because if the plane just continues unimpeded, it implies that no force is acting upon it, and that therefore the building itself represents no force.
Right. That would be akin to firing a .357 Magnum bullet through a balsa wood or a sheet of paper, and you would expect the airplane to come out the other side of the building if there is virtually no force applied.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Completing my conversation today with Morgan Reynolds, who's a very smart guy and has got a lot to say, and I just want everyone to mark their calendar that I'm having Morgan back on the 23rd to continue our conversation. That's going to be this coming Tuesday. So you're going to have an opportunity for two more hours of conversation with Morgan Reynolds. Morgan, we're talking about Newton's laws, and I think that you've got a pretty powerful anvil and hammer with which to go after NIST, and it's stunning to me how they can attempt to defend the indefensible.
It is. It is. That's how far we've sunk, I think. And everybody knows that in a collision, the stronger and more massive body or object is going to fare better. So, for example, if you're shopping for a car, should I buy this heavy SUV for safety, or should I accept the risk of driving an econo car or a sports car, or in my case, a motorcycle? I mean, in other words, this business about an aluminum airplane, because it's got a lot of speed and therefore kinetic energy,
yes,
the pushback, I'm sorry, is just all the more. And which I did some rough and ready calculations. For example, we can't just go with the 500,000 tons. All right, well, let's just look at the weight, the mass, if you will, of five floors. And that's about 100 times this alleged 140-ton aircraft, right?
Yeah.
So it's just a colossal mismatch. So one way to picture this, if we take Newton's laws to heart, especially the third, that the forces occur in pairs and they're equal and opposite on both bodies, then imagine the tower. We don't need a whole lot of speed. Imagine the tower just falls on a parked airplane.
Yeah.
That's how the airplane is going to fare.
Or think maybe of trying to punch your fist through an engine block.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a good one. And here, by contrast, Jim, let me quote from Liz.
Maybe if you hit it really, really, really fast.
Yeah, get your fist really rolling, really rev it up like a fastball pitcher.
That's right. Right. And that engine block that's just sitting there after all, I mean, how much resistance can it have?
You know, when the other side gets desperate, when I start hammering them with Newton's laws of physics,
then
they come up with, oh, we know that straws can penetrate a tree or telephone pole.
Uh-huh.
And while there, I just pulled out the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's proposition that, hey, in a tornado, these objects bend. And you got a lot of straw flying. It's not surprising one of them will fit into these now wider cracks.
That's right.
And then they bend back up, and they're trapped.
Yeah.
You know, they don't show any these straws penetrating engine blocks.
That's right. It looks impressive, but the explanation is completely different.
listen to these guys at NIST. If I quote, I can hammer them that they do violate the basic laws of physics as Sir Isaac Newton has laid them out. And NIST, by contrast, they go on with their all pomposity about experts, consultants, all agreed with the approach taken by NIST to analyze the aircraft impact, etc. Finally, they're going to give us empirical validation, Jim. Here's their sentence. Finally, because of the large amount of independent photographic and video data available for the World Trade Center towers, NIST was able to compare its analytical results with the observable data to verify that the models accurately captured the observed behavior of the WTC towers. In other words, they're using these fake videos to they're locked into their videos, and modeling have to comport with each other.
Of course, the rate of pulverization, the degree of pulverization, the turning of these buildings into very fine dust contradicts everything NIST has ever said. Not to mention their study of 236 samples of steel, of which 233 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, and the other three not above 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. That shows their dedication to empirical evidence.
Right, and that's on the other issue of what caused the destruction of the towers, which is really an independent issue from the aircraft analysis.
Morgan, I can't let you get away today without talking about figure one here. You got this cookie cutter cutout. I just am fascinated by that.
Right, yeah, and figure one shows
right
the cartoon-like silhouette of passage. And then below it, I've got figure two with Wile E. Coyote looking at a silhouette of passage from the Roadrunner going through the Acme plate steel.
Yeah.
And,
I love
and
it.
And then, of course, you know, I've got help from you-know-who on this. We've got the Roadrunner imprint on the South Tower.
But
I mean,
but
it's about that dumb.
Explain why this is so very telling.
Well, I can remember, Jim, when learning the morning of 9/11, I was actually scrambling to get across the Potomac River and, you know, how they flushed out all the bureaucrats and we were trying to get home. So, and I'd arrived in town so recently I didn't see the TV coverage, okay? But I remember scratching my head. The next day when I'd learned, I said, well, could an airplane really do that? And you know how you look around and say, well, nobody else is doubting this, right?
Yeah.
Where were the scientists and engineers who should have been doing this secondhand to them, but unknown to me, really, right? They should have been doing this analysis. But the trouble is, one of the hugest problems here is that the engineering and science community are pretty much poodles of the government. You know how their careers depend on government approval in one form or another. So
you think speaking out could jeopardize their careers, their contracts,
right,
their budgets, their funding, their grants,
right,
their grants?
Yes, right. And, you know, the zoning requirements, the building codes, and so on and so forth. And they just don't want to go there, even though, of course, we've got some crossovers from the engineering community, the most important one being Dr. Judy Wood. But it's still lamentable that I can remember years ago, Jim, there was a debate between Milton Friedman and I can't remember if he had his debate opponent was Paul Samuelson or Galbraith. But in any event, it came up in the Q&A that what about the NSF, the National Science Foundation? And to make his longer answer short, he said, I'm against it because of the nationalization of the science community. We're better off with other funding mechanisms and a more competitive and less monolithic establishment. And that's part of the problem.
Well, you know, Morgan, private entities are buying up whole departments and giving them funding and all that. I mean, it's even at Harvard, they had a department bought up by a pharmaceutical giant, in essence.
Right. That's nothing I can approve of either. The patent medicine community, I've got nothing but ill attitudes toward them.
How can the university perform their vital function of independent criticism and analysis of what's going on in the world to be the truth teller of last resort?
I can remember prior to where I am now, I used to think that, well, the universities are gone, and this is just another illustration of it, and that the think tanks would be an alternative. But there again, you got all kinds of bought up
political corruption. Morgan, I can't thank you enough. I look forward to having you back on Tuesday. Everybody, mark your calendar. We're just getting warmed up with Morgan Reynolds, my special guest today on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host. Thank you for listening.